Ives. Rifling through a notepad, she found many to-do lists and many calls to Gemma's father. She wondered whether he was already on his way. More likely, he had simply sent someone to take care of Lyra and Selim. He was the kind of person who spoke through his money. She stuffed her pockets with paper, with post-it notes, with business cards and scrawled reminders, evidence, although she still wasn't sure what it proved. But every piece of paper, every scrap, hardened a sense of rage and injustice. If she had any time left, any time at all, she would take the words and light them on fire so they would explode everywhere. They would drift like a cloud and blacken Dr. O'Donnell's name and Kasich's name and Jeffrey Ives' name, too. Even if she died, she would find a way to make the words live. In the bottom drawer, behind a rubble of loose pens, they found a handful of bobby pins. Selim straightened out one of the bobby pins and inserted it into the keyhole, wiggling until he heard it click. In less than 5 seconds, they were free. The hallway was empty and branched in both directions. Lyra saw no exit signs and couldn't remember which way to go. The night before, she'd been too overwhelmed to pay attention. Selim had been brought in by security and was distracted by a small cluster of people who had gathered to watch, but he thought they should turn left, and so they did. Selim was right about the rest of K6. It was all carpeted hallways and offices marked with unfamiliar names, conference rooms and cubicles. Lyra saw signs of the previous night's celebration, a bottle of wine uncorked, and plastic cups that had pooled liquid onto a conference table. There were coffee mugs still exhaling steam at empty desks and abandoned jackets, purses, and cell phones everywhere, suggesting their owners had indeed come to work only to be spirited away. Fear moved like a film of sweat across Lyra's body. The hallway seemed to keep unrolling extra feet, stretching endlessly past the same bleak workstations, as if it were expanding. She kept spinning around, thinking she heard footsteps on the carpet, expecting to see Dr. O'Donnell bearing down on them. But they saw no one but a guy wedged into a cubicle, fiddling with a grid of numbers on his computer, ears obscured beneath palm-sized headphones. He didn't see them. Finally, the hallway dead-ended and they turned right, startling a girl holding a bakery box. She nearly dropped it, yelped, and turned to hurry away, as if she had reason to be afraid of them. "We have to hurry," Selim said, as if Lyra didn't know. But she spotted a set of double doors where the girl had whipped out of sight around another turn, and she and Selim grabbed hands and ran. Lyra's heart was gasping. As they got close, she thought it might burst. She saw a keypad like the kind they had used at Haven, which required an ID to swipe, but the doors had been propped open with an old paperback book, and beyond them was a stairwell and a sign pointing the way to further levels. The stairs went down and twisted them around several landings, past a level called Sub 1, which was unlit. Through a set of swinging doors, Lyra saw a vast room filled with nothing but old machines, abandoned workstations, and freight containers. The double doors opened at her touch. "In here?" she whispered to Selim. But just then, a patter of footsteps passed overhead, and he shook his head and pulled her on. As they descended, the air got noticeably cooler. Lyra remembered what the boy had said about a refrigerator. She pictured an enormous, chilled space like a dead heart, filled with endless chambers. The stairs bottomed out at a heavy metal gate. This one was closed and required a digitized code to open. Beyond it was a plain white windowless door, fitted with yet another keypad and marked with a small sign that simply said, "Secure Area, Live Samples." Lyra's blood rushed a frantic rhythm to her head, and in its rhythm she heard the certainty of dark secrets. Whatever Kasich's made, whatever Dr. O'Donnell built, with all her wanting, it was here. They had no choice but to backtrack. The climb left Lyra winded, and she had to rest on the landing, leaning heavily against Selim, before they slipped once again through the propped-open doors at the top of the stairs. Maybe, Lyra thought, there was no exit. Maybe Dr. O'Donnell had trapped them, the way in the early days Haven had placed rats in mazes that didn't lead anywhere, to test how long it took for the sick ones to learn all the dead ends. They turned again, and this time Lyra's heart leapt. An exit sign pointed through a set of doors only 20 feet away. She was so happy she failed to register the sudden swell of voices. She slipped easily away from Selim, even as he tried to grab her. "Era, wait!" But she had started toward the sign already, hooked on the glowing comfort of its syllables. Exit. A funny word, and one she had only lately come to love. At Haven, she had always thought the exit signs were taunting her. She was halfway there when the wave of voices finally broke across her consciousness, as if the sound was a physical substance and she had mindlessly stepped into its current. 40 or 50 people were gathered in a conference room to crowd around a wall-mounted TV. Had they been turned to face the hallway instead, Lyra would have been visible. She was rooted directly in the middle of the doorway, frozen with sudden terror. Dr. Saperstein was staring directly at her. For a confused and terrified second, she mistook the image for the real thing and thought he was really there, staring bleakly over all the Kasich's employees, pinning her with his eyes. But of course he wasn't. It was just an old picture, an image made huge by the television. Almost immediately, Dr. Saperstein vanished, and a female newscaster with stiff black hair and an even stiffer smile took over the screen. The rush of blood in Lyra's ears quieted, but just for a minute. Confirmed that Dr. Mark Saperstein was indeed found dead this morning at an undisclosed location. A microwave beeped. No one bothered with it. They were all still. Lyra felt as if the air was being pressed out of her lungs. Though Dr. Saperstein had just undergone a spectacularly public fall from grace, culminating in this week's protests at his alma mater, the University of Pennsylvania, the police have denied reports that his death was a suicide. Dead. 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 The word kept drilling in Lyra's mind. Dr. Saperstein was dead. God was dead. She should have been happy, but strangely, she was just frightened. It had never occurred to her that God would die, or that it was even possible. She was less than 15 feet from the exit. No one had seen her, and yet she couldn't move. And even Selim hesitated, teetering on the edge of the doorway as if it were a river he was worried about crossing. 8 seconds, maybe 10, 12 at a stretch. God had died, and with him, the replica's only reason for being. Was a terrible reason better than no reason at all? There they are! Get them! Get them! Lyra turned and saw Dr. O'Donnell charging them and trailing a small crowd of people behind her. Among them were 3 guards and the girl who dropped the bakery box. And at the same time, in response to her shout, everyone in the conference room turned and spotted Lyra. She ran. Selim was shouting over the sudden chaos. And though she couldn't hear him, she could feel him a step behind her. They had a small advantage, but it was enough. They were steps from the door, inches. They could get outside. They would be free. But even as Lyra reached for the door, it opened forcefully from the other side. Selim managed to pull up, but Lyra was thrown backward by the blunt collision, as with a hard and hollow smack, the door caught her in the side of her jaw. She landed on her back, breathless and dizzy. Through a fuzz of dark shapes, she saw a whip-thin man, soaked with toppled coffee, gaping at her. Selim tried to get her to her feet, but by then Dr. O'Donnell had caught up, and the guards drove him to his knees, and Lyra saw a thicket grow above her, a nest of mouths and unfamiliar faces, long arms that looked like weapons, cold fingers locked her wrists in place, someone sat on her ankles. "They look so real," somebody said. "You'd never know." "Be careful how you handle them, please." That was Dr. O'Donnell. "It looks like they may be the last ones."
Gemma. 20. "Something's wrong," Gemma said. She thought of the way Calliope had flown at her sharp-fisted hands, the sour heat of her breath. "What if they never come back?"
"That's an understatement," Pete said.
He smiled, but only halfway, as if he couldn't quite remember how to do it. "No." He didn't see. He hadn't seen how Calliope looked, and hadn't heard what she'd said. "I mean, whoever lives here should have come back by now. They should have come home. Why haven't they?"
"Hey."
Pete had to step very carefully. He wasn't wearing shoes, and the floor was still littered with glass.
"Deep breath, okay? You're just scared."
"What if... What if Calliope did something to them? She choked on the words, on the very idea of it, and Pete put his arms around her as if he knew it was the only way to keep her on her feet.
Come on, he said. It's all right. Home stretch. You're exhausted.
You're not listening to me. Gemma pulled away and saw reality for a moment like a fabric sail, blowing away from its mast, straining in invisible currents. She asked me what would happen if they never came back.
She's never been outside, Gemma, Pete said. She has no idea what to think.
Gemma shook her head. Her mouth tasted like vomit. She was dizzy with confusion and fear. Where are they, then? You said yourself it's not like they went on a road trip. Pete's hair was wet. When he pushed a hand through it, water sprayed through his fingers.
Maybe they walked into town.
What town? Gemma no longer cared that she was shouting. I haven't seen a town, have you, Pete? In fact, I think the whole reason we're here is that there is no fucking town.
He threw up his hands and let them fall hard, a clapping sound that made Gemma flinch.
So maybe they went to a picnic, or a ukulele bonfire, or to make soap out of lye or something. How should I know?
Pete was doing his best to be nice, but she could tell he was losing patience. His irritation kept showing, like the nub of something sharp rubbing up beneath a sweater, distorting the fabric.
I mean, shit. She doesn't even know what a barn is. What could she possibly have done?
She knows what a barn is, Gemma said. A stupid response, but she was on the verge of tears again. She called it by name. She's smarter than you know.
Pete frowned. She was worried he would tell her she was being crazy again, and that she would start to cry, but he just shook his head.
Look, I can't imagine what it's like for you.
He broke off, shaking his head.
I mean, being with her, seeing your face.
He smiled, but only barely.
It's weird even for me. When you're standing next to each other.
He reached out and knuckled the counter, like there was an insect there he needed to crush.
I'd be freaking out, too.
Gemma felt a chill go through her. She was a cold mist, barely hanging together.
You think I'm freaking out, she said.
He looked at her, pale eyelashes, freckles, lips, the coral inside of his nose. She'd studied his face so often, thinking it beautiful, thinking it hers. But the face was just collision, random physical accumulation that meant nothing.
Anyone would freak out.
He tried to take her hand, but she balled her fist, and weirdly enough, her other hand, the injured one, pulsed with sudden pain, as if she'd balled that instead.
She's not you. She's nothing like you. You shouldn't be afraid.
I don't think she's like me, Gemma said. I don't think she's anything like me.
But she realized, even as she said it, that this wasn't exactly true. Wasn't that the whole point? She could have been Calliope, and Calliope could have been her. People became different bodies by chance or accident or God, depending on what you believed. But if you had the same body, the same voice, the same hair and fingers and eyes and nails, then how did you know the difference? She would have to separate from Calliope, cleave her like some horrible head in a fairy tale, and even then she would have had that doubleness inside her.
Go rinse off, Pete said, in a voice she hated.
It was a tone her father used, hooking on to an I know best kind of thing.
It will make you feel better, I promise. By the time you get out, what do you want to bet we'll be hitching a ride back to the 21st century in a buggy?
Gemma couldn't smile, even though she knew he was only trying to help. She wouldn't let him help her to the washroom either, even though she was hobbling on her swollen ankle and had to lean on the furniture for support. The bathtub was old and spotted with rust. Pete had left blood behind, too, a faint ring of it where the water had turned color, and more funneling toward the drain. She pumped for water and was shocked by how cold it was. But at the same time, she liked it, and liked the smell, too, like spring soil and dirt newly turned over. She stripped out of the clothes she'd been issued at the holding center
and maneuvered into the tub, trying not to put weight on her ankle, and careful, too, not to use her left hand. The shock of cold water, even at her ankles, made her gasp, and instinctively she went for a knob that wasn't there. Then she wanted to cry again, not for the lack, but for all the things she had always used, for how lucky she was, and for her life, pure and simple, for the ability to stand naked and hurt ankle deep in cold water. She was alive. She'd made it out. Goose pimples raised the hair on her thighs and forearms. The water took blood from her skin and swirled it into pink. She was ugly and damaged, and for an instant she didn't care. She was alive. Her ribs held her. Her heart held her. The world held her. It bound her like a promise. Pete was right. She did feel better, infinitely better, once she'd watched a film of soot and dirt and blood wash away, as if it was carrying the memory of what had happened. Still, she was uneasy. She hadn't heard anyone come back. The house was still silent, still wound up, like a coiled spring. There were towels pegged to the wall, and she took one. In an adjacent room, she found a closet full of dresses, like the one Calliope had chosen, and she rooted around in a drawer until she found pants, a white shirt, and a dark vest, all of them obviously meant for a guy. But a pair of sandals wedged beneath the simple bed fit her pretty well, and she almost laughed when, feeling something crunch in the pocket of the vest, she fished out a half-empty pack of Marlboro Lights and a Bic lighter decorated with a peeling Steelers logo. So, there were rule breakers here, too. Pete wasn't in the kitchen, although he'd swept up the glass. Calliope wasn't back either. In an instant, all her good feeling was swept away. She stood drowning in the air, in the emptiness. She was alone. She was suddenly terrified. She launched herself to the door, ignoring the pain in her ankle, crying out. There was something behind her, something too terrible to look at. The weight of her fear had transformed into a monster. She was outside, and the light was blinding. The cows moving across the pasture calmed her only slightly. She was alone and lost. She was shouting Pete's name without even meaning to, and when she saw movement inside the barn, the shift of color and shadow, she went toward it with her arms outstretched.
"Don't! Don't!"
His voice stopped her. She'd never heard anyone sound like that, and in that moment, though she was still standing in the sun, the shadow of the monster behind her reached out and swallowed them.
"Don't come in here. Don't."
For a moment he was still invisible. He was corners of himself, an arm and a leg, trying to move out of sticky darkness. And she was drawn toward him, to reach him, to pull him away, and so even as he plunged outside like someone diving in reverse, she saw behind him the shoes attached to the ankles, and an arm, a small arm, a young arm, held motionless in a slant of light. Even if she hadn't, she would have known by Pete's face. It was as if all the skin had come off, as if the fear had come down and planed away everything else. The barn is where the animals go to die. He grabbed her, and this time Gemma felt that he was the one in danger of falling.
"We can't stay here," he said. "We've got to get out of here. We have to get out now."
There was blood on his shoes. She couldn't move. Her thoughts had frozen. They were rattling together like cubes in a tray. "What happened?" she asked, even though she knew. But she couldn't quite make sense of it, the pale child's arm reaching into a triangle of sun, and a man's feet fanned apart. Bodies.
"Jesus,"
Pete was crying. He turned away from her and bent to put his hands on his knees, trying to breathe, retching a little.
"Jesus Christ."
He just kept saying it over and over.
"Jesus. Jesus."
And Gemma felt the clean brightness of the sky above them, felt all the emptiness of that endless hurdle into space. "She killed them," she said. The words didn't sound real. Pete just nodded. He was still doubled over. She wanted to put a hand on his back, but she couldn't make her arm obey the command. "The barn is where the animals go to die." Where was she now? Where had she gone? Gemma was freezing, gripped by fear. In the distance, the woods rippled as a breeze passed through the trees. Was someone shouting? She couldn't think. She thought she heard voices crying out. "We can't stay here," she said, as Pete had, but neither of them moved. It was like a nightmare. Too bright, too warm, too empty. Voices. She definitely heard voices now. Not the phantoms, but real people. In the distance, a long trail of orange dust unfurled, and then she saw horse carts, three of them, and a cluster of people. They were coming fast, and for a moment she felt nothing but relief. They were saved. Pete had her shoulders. He shook her, and her teeth jumped together.
"You need to run. Don't you understand? We can't be here. They can't find you here."
"What are you talking about?" Her thoughts were still frozen into uselessness. The wagons were closer now. The ground shivered under the vibration of so many hooves. She could make out the men inside them, all men, all dressed in black, all shouting. There was a boy, too, maybe 13 or 14. He was standing, balancing like a sailor on a rolling sea deck, scouting for sure. He was pointing.
"Listen to me, Gemma!"
Pete was shouting, but she couldn't hear him properly.
"Run, Gemma. Listen to me. You gotta move."
She'd already lifted a hand to wave back, to hail the people in the wagon, because they were waving too, because the boy in front, the one who reminded her of a sailor, was pointing at her. Pointing. Shouting. Angry. And suddenly she remembered what Calliope had said. "There was a male. He ran off when he saw me." The cooled coffee with milk congealing into a pale skin on its surface. Half-eaten toast. "You can be my replica." The men were pouring down off the wagons now, shouting, as the boy stood still with a finger raised, trembling and white-faced with fury. And finally Gemma heard him over the rattling of her heart, over the fear that had her in its grip.
"That's her!"
he was saying. He had the beginnings of a beard, dark and patchy, and a long, narrow face, but it was his eyes that struck her. They were large and terrible, like holes that had been gouged into his face.
"That's her! That one! That's her!"
Pete shoved her. The shock of pain when she stepped on her ankle jolted her into her body, into understanding. Calliope had killed people, and Calliope had disappeared, and Gemma, her replica, would be her substitute.
"Run!"
They were swarming toward her, jackets flapping in the wind like capes, so she was reminded of insects, of biblical locusts coming down to bring punishment. Finally, Gemma ran.
Lyra, 20. This time they were placed in an unused office whose only furniture was a set of metal filing cabinets and two chairs brought in for Selim and Lyra to sit on, although Selim remained standing. The door required a key. Dr. O'Donnell had locked them in herself. "Give me a minute," she'd told them almost apologetically. She couldn't stop pretending that she was on their side. She probably didn't know the difference. Standing with her ear to the door, Lyra could hear Dr. O'Donnell speaking to someone in the hall. "She says they came here on their own, with no help. I doubt she knows a thing." There was only silence in response, and Lyra realized that Dr. O'Donnell was talking on the phone. Her skin tightened into a shiver. Dr. O'Donnell knew the suits. How long would it be before they arrived? "She hasn't mentioned Gemma at all, but I can ask." Another silence. "You think she ended up there by mistake?" Lyra leaned so hard against the door, sweat gathered in the space behind her ear. For a long time, Dr. O'Donnell said nothing, and Lyra worried she might have hung up. But then she spoke again. I'm sure she's okay, Jeff. I'm sure she made it out. Then, no, I understand that, but she's a smart girl. You've said so yourself. Lyra put a hand on the door and pressed, imagining she could squeeze her rage out through her fingertips, harden it into blades that would slice them free. Jeff meant Jeffrey Ives. Though she didn't understand much of the conversation, she understood that something bad had happened to Gemma. Something had happened to her, by mistake. She was in trouble, and Lyra knew without question or doubt, and without knowing how she knew, that it was because Gemma had come to warn her. Had Gemma, like Rick, been taken away? She thought of Jake Witz hanging by his belt, and the purple mottle of his face. The memory brought back a roar of sound, a memory of Haven exploding into flame, and the char of burning skin carrying over the marshes. She nearly missed the next thing Dr. O'Donnell said. I see. So how many of them escaped? Then, we can still use them, you know, if we could spin it. She broke off. After another minute, she spoke again, this time so close to the door that Lyra startled backward and could still hear her clearly. Well, maybe it's for the best. Public support will be the trickiest. If word gets out that they can be violent... The last thing she said was, I'm praying for Gemma. Lyra couldn't help but wonder whether anyone in the whole world was praying for her and for Selim. She doubted it. Then Lyra had to stumble out of the way because Dr. O'Donnell turned the key in the lock and opened the door. For a half second, Lyra didn't recognize her. The lines of her face had converged into a baffling question mark. Sit, Dr. O'Donnell said. Neither Selim nor Lyra moved. Go on, sit, please. I won't hurt you. You're a liar, Selim said. Everything you say is a lie. Dr. O'Donnell sighed. She must have gone home at some point to change. She was wearing different clothing than she had been last night. Lyra hated her for this, that she would think to go home, that she would think to shower, that Lyra and Selim were so small in the orbit of her life they hadn't even caused a ripple in her routine. I wasn't lying when I said I could help you, Dr. O'Donnell said. I'm sure I don't need to tell you this, but you're in a difficult position. You're not supposed to exist. Although she said the words gently, Lyra knew them for what they were. Sharp, weaponized things, knives designed to make her bleed. She wouldn't argue or cry or show that they had landed. What happened to Gemma? She said. Dr. O'Donnell looked momentarily startled, and Lyra was glad. She had an advantage, however brief. Dr. O'Donnell recovered quickly. You're very observant, she said. I'd forgotten that. There wasn't much to do but observe at Haven, Lyra said. A wave of dizziness clouded her vision, and she wanted to sit down but didn't want to give Dr. O'Donnell the satisfaction. What happened to Gemma? I don't know, Dr. O'Donnell said after a short pause. No one knows. It seems she disappeared on Sunday morning. So, it was Lyra's fault. Dr. O'Donnell moved away from the door, slowly, as if Selim and Lyra might startle, as if there was anywhere for them to go. Can I ask you a question? She held up both hands when Selim started to protest. Then you can ask me anything you want, and I'll be honest. I promise to tell you everything you want to know. Selim's eyes locked briefly on Lyra's. She shrugged. Go on, Lyra said. Finally, she took a seat, hoping that Dr. O'Donnell hadn't noticed her relief. Selim, however, stayed where he was. But then it's our turn. Dr. O'Donnell called up a smile with obvious difficulty. I promise, she repeated. Since Selim wasn't sitting, she took the empty chair instead and drew it across from Lyra, so they were almost knee-to-knee. She leaned forward, and Lyra was sure she would ask about Gemma. But instead, she said, Do you know how many replicas escaped Haven after the explosion? Now Lyra was the one who was surprised. Why does it matter? Selim asked. Dr. O'Donnell barely turned her head to give him a tight smile. You said you'd answer first. Lyra shook her head. I don't know, she answered honestly. Selim and I were hiding. We got under the fence. When she closed her eyes, she could still see the zigzag of flashlights and hear the rhythm of helicopters threshing the smoke beneath their propellers. Dozens of them passing back and forth, back and forth. She remembered screaming. There were rescue helicopters, though. So there must have been some. Dr. Saperstein survived, didn't he? Dr. O'Donnell nodded. The explosion happened in A-Wing, but there wouldn't have been replicas there. Dr. O'Donnell was quiet for a bit. She clutched her hands, making her knuckles very white. Were they really the same hands, Lyra wondered, that had smuggled books onto Spruce Island, had touched Lyra's forehead when she was feverish? Why? Selim asked again. When she looked down at her hands, he said, You promised to answer. Dr. O'Donnell shook herself as if she were passing out of a rain. I never liked what Dr. Saperstein was doing at Haven, she said. Research of that magnitude... She cleared her throat. Secrets breed violence. The bigger the secret, the bigger the violence. Suddenly she stood up, moving not toward the door but to a barred window with a view of nothing but a blight of straggly trees. Dr. Saperstein is dead. His secrets killed him, and it's possible, it's likely, that the replicas he brought up from Florida managed to escape. Where? Lyra asked. I don't know. Dr. O'Donnell turned to them when Selim made a noise in his throat. That's the truth. I don't know. Somewhere in Lancaster County, only an hour or so south of here, that's all I know. We weren't exactly on the best of terms. He was suing you, Lyra said, parroting back what Sebastian had told her. Again, Dr. O'Donnell looked surprised. You were always very smart, Dr. O'Donnell said. Lyra wanted to hit her. She gripped the sides of her chair as another wave of dizziness nearly took her sideways. What do you make here if you aren't making cures? Dr. O'Donnell turned back to the window. She waited so long to answer, Lyra began to think that her promise had also been a lie. But finally she did. Dr. Haven and Dr. Saperstein were convinced that their work could only be done in secret, she said. That was wrong. You said that already, Selim said. Just listen. A sigh moved from Dr. O'Donnell's shoulders down her spine. I've spent years doing nothing but speaking to people, scientists, engineers, politicians even, about how important this research is, how important it should be. Lyra decided she hated that word, important. The way Dr. O'Donnell said it made her want to spit. As if it were a beautiful piece of glass. As if Dr. O'Donnell was beautiful just because she carried its syllables around on her tongue. How many people, Lyra wondered, were dead because of someone else's importance? That's what we do at K6. We promote research. We give hospitals, facilities, even governments the chance to do their own research. That's where you come in. Dr. O'Donnell turned away from the window again. She wasn't smiling. There's nowhere else for you to go. I know you understand that. If you leave, you'll eventually be caught by the same people who wanted to erase you in the first place. I'm dying anyway, Lyra said, aren't I? Dr. O'Donnell winced as if Lyra had fired something sharp at her forehead. You lied about a cure, Lyra said, although the words curdled in her mouth and left her with a bad taste in her throat. Admit it. Dr. O'Donnell looked down. There's no cure, she said softly. But Lyra thought, unbelievably, that she really sounded sorry about it. Still, the words fell like a thin knife, Lyra felt, slicing the world in two. She remembered the moment that Selim had grabbed her wrist and she'd seen his mud-coated nails and felt the strange warmth and newness of his touch, and then a rocketing blast had driven her off her feet. She had thought then that the world might be ending. Instead, it was ending here, in this room.
"We hardly understand prions," Dr. O'Donnell said.
Dr. Saperstein understood them better than anyone in the world, probably, and he wasn't looking for a cure. The whole point was to study a class of disease that we knew hardly anything about, to see how it could be manipulated, to understand it by making different variations and observing their effects. She shook her head. He was collecting data. It had to be incurable. Lyra thought of all the replicas she'd ever known. Lilac Springs and Rose and Cassiopeia, and the hundreds of numbered ones they'd never named, standing in a vast row against a blinding sunshine, looking like pen strokes on a page, looking like data. "So why does it matter?" Lyra said. "Why does it matter if I'm just going to die?" Dr. O'Donnell looked up. "I'm offering you more time," she said. Years collapsed in a second. Just for a second, Lyra fell back into the fantasy of Dr. O'Donnell as her savior, as her mother, as her friend. "We don't want anything from you," Selim said. At the same time, Lyra asked, "How?" Dr. O'Donnell spoke in a quiet rhythm Lyra knew from their Sunday readings. "Most people in the world, the vast majority of people, don't even know it's possible to clone human beings. They've heard about cloning sheep and cloning human organs, even dogs, apes, cows on rare occasions, but Haven's work was kept so confidential, secret, I mean, that most people, if you told them a single human clone was alive in the world, eating, breathing, thinking, they wouldn't believe it." When Dr. O'Donnell spoke, it was like the soft touch of a sleeper. Lyra's mind turned dull and soft and malleable. "You're our proof." She could have laughed. She wanted to cry. "I'm not proof." "I didn't mean it that way," Dr. O'Donnell said. "I only meant..." Lyra cut her off. "No. You don't understand. I'm not proof. I'm not even a replica. I wasn't made at Haven. I wasn't made at all." She felt both satisfied and sickened at the fault line of disappointment that shook Dr. O'Donnell's face. "You didn't know? I have a father. His name is Rick Harless. I had a mother, too, but she didn't want me, so she gave me over to Haven, and then she died." Saying it out loud gave her the good kind of pain, like digging in the gums with a fingernail. "I wasn't made by anything except accident. No one wanted me at all." That was really what had made Selim so special to her. He wanted her. And not just because of her body and what he could do with it, but for her, something inside neither of them had a name for, the stitching and the thread that held her whole life as a spider web holds even the sunlight that passes through it. "There were more of us at Haven. Not just me. Replicas are expensive." She remembered that day on the marshes, the soldiers saying, "You know how expensive these things are to make?" "I guess that means I was cheap." Dr. O'Donnell shook her head. "I'm sorry," she said. Lyra wanted to ask whether she was sorry for Lyra or for herself. "I heard rumors, but that was all before my time. It was the most dangerous kind of lie. The one the liar believed." "That's convenient for you," she said. She felt a hard, ugly pull of hatred. Was this all the world was? They'd escaped Haven only to find that Haven existed everywhere? Dr. O'Donnell stood up. She stared down at Lyra as if from an enormous height. But when she spoke, she sounded calm. "If you understand anything, I want you to try and understand this," she said. "We're all doing our best. We always have been." But her mouth twisted around the words, and Lyra wondered if on some level even her body knew that was a lie, or at least that it wasn't an excuse.
Haven was a crazy place, such a crazy time for everyone. I posted there for 3 years, and I remember I would leave for the holidays, step off that launch, and hardly remember how to be human. Bad choice of words, and she seemed to realize it. Lyra and Selim had no idea what any of it meant. The holidays, family, Haven as a fluid world that allowed passage in and out. Some people might think what we did was wrong. Maybe it was, but it was also a miracle. It was maybe the first scientific miracle. She almost looked like she might cry. You make choices. You make sacrifices. Sometimes you make the wrong choices. Then you work to correct them. That's what science is about. Lyra wanted to argue because she knew there was some problem of logic there. There had to be. Anyone could give names to anything. Dr. O'Donnell had taught her that when she'd given Lyra her name. If you could do anything you wanted and then call it doing your best, you could invent anything, excuse anything. There had to be a center somewhere. There had to be a truth. But suddenly, Lyra found she couldn't bring up the words she wanted to say. The word center, for example, she could picture it, see it as a hard little seed at the back of her tongue, but she couldn't find the word. This was a hole of a different kind. She wasn't dropping into it. It was reaching up to swallow her. Lyra thought of the pages she'd eaten in Sebastian's bathroom and the words all dissolving into her blood. She wished she hadn't. Now she was nauseous and thought that they were the things poisoning her, saw the letters reconfigure themselves into deformities like little mangled prions and float carelessly toward her heart. Words could make anything. That was their great power and their great danger. Lyra saw that now. Dr. O'Donnell had already started moving for the door when Selim spoke up again. I have another question. She turned around, keeping her hand on the door. Someone blew up Haven because of their idea of God. Selim said, You know that? Dr. O'Donnell frowned. I'd heard. And Haven was for science. And it killed people, too. Dr. O'Donnell said nothing. Selim took a step toward her and then another. Dr. O'Donnell's whole body tensed. My question is this. He stopped when he was no more than 4 inches away from her, and Lyra could see how badly Dr. O'Donnell wanted to flee, how hard she was trying not to throw the door open and run. If it's okay to kill people for science, or for God, is it okay to kill people if you think you need to? Of course not, she said sharply. Why not? He spoke the words softly, but she flinched. I don't expect you to understand. She couldn't control herself anymore. She wrenched the door open, forcing him to step back. The world isn't black and white. There are no easy answers. Still, Selim wasn't done. You said the world isn't black and white. But the world isn't like you think it is, either, he said quietly. Dr. O'Donnell froze. I watched. There were days I watched so much I thought I wasn't even a person, just an eye. And even I know that when you push and you keep pushing, someday, sometime, someone is going to push you back. Dr. O'Donnell turned to face him very slowly. Are you threatening me, Selim? I don't need to, he said. That's just the way the world works. He smiled, too. We all do our best, like you said. Dr. O'Donnell opened her mouth, but Lyra couldn't hear her response. A sound filled her ears like the sifting of wind across the desert, a sound of huge emptiness, and her body disappeared, and Dr. O'Donnell and Selim in the room disappeared, and darkness lifted up and swallowed her like a wave.
Gemma, 21. She lost sight of Pete almost immediately. Pain darkened her vision every time she put weight on her left ankle, and her ankle kept folding, rolling her down to her hands and knees. She lost one sandal. She fell, got up, fell, got up. She could hear the men shouting behind her, tunneling toward her like a wave, but she was too afraid to look and see how close they were. She was choking on her own spit, blind with pain and panic. Down, up again. In the fields, the cows watched her lazily, flicking their tails. The woods were impossibly far. She kept running anyway, up and down the swells of land, falling and climbing again to her feet, swallowing her snot. Then she had crossed the expanse of green and hit the fence, running into it with hardly a break in her step, simply plunging over it, toppling, rolling on her shoulder, and then hauling herself again to her feet, sheltered in the sudden shadows, ping-ponging from tree to tree, using her good hand. She tripped and slid down a steep embankment, through a mulch of rotting tree bark. At the bottom of the slope, an enormous felled tree wheeled its roots to the sky. An overhanging lip of earth made a kind of tunnel, and she saw at once this was her only chance, to hide, to wait, to hope that the men missed her. She scuttled backward into the soft rot of this long, damp space. The air smelled like moisture, pulped leaves, and decay. She waited, shivering, her arms around her knees, listening to the distant shouting of her pursuers. At one point, they seemed to be almost directly on top of her, and fear turned her stomach to liquid. But then they passed on. She lost track of time. Her terror turned every second into a swampy hour, a long agony of waiting. Finally, she realized the woods were quiet. She couldn't hear anyone shouting. She hadn't heard anyone shout in a long time. Carefully, she shimmied out of her hiding place, still pausing every few breaths to listen for footsteps or the sound of voices. Nothing. Now that her panic had eased up, the pain in her ankle had redoubled. It took her 20 minutes to work her way up the slope she'd tumbled down in seconds. At the top of the embankment, she stood, trying to catch her breath, waving away a cloud of gnats that rose in a swarm. Afternoon sunlight made elegant angles through the trees. That meant hours had passed. She hoped the men who were after her had given up. She wondered what had happened to Calliope, whether she too had made her escape through the woods. She thought she remembered which direction she'd come from. She would have to go the opposite way or risk ending up right where she started. If this was farmland, she comforted herself with the idea that she would have to reach another farm eventually, preferably one wired for the 21st century, where no one believed that she was a murderer. Even better, she might find a road full of traffic, full of normal people, soccer moms and dentists and teenage drivers with both hands on the wheel. She swore then that if she ever made it home, she would never complain ever about being bored. She wanted to be bored every day of her natural life. She wanted to die of boredom, literally. So she went on, hobbling, limping, leaning heavily on a stick she fished out from the underbrush. She had to stop and rewrap her ankle twice, clumsily because she had only one hand, because she was shaking so hard, and the skin was so enormously puffy it frightened her. Miles of land, tight-knit woods of oak and maple and birch, dappled sun, and the sky held at bay by the canopy of branches, the occasional flash of a deer bounding off in the distance, broken stone foundations that might have existed since the days of Paul Revere. She kept telling herself there had to be a road soon, soon, soon. The afternoon lengthened. The shadows turned the color of a bruise. More than once, she imagined she heard the noise of traffic. There, over that ridge, just behind that stand of trees, she could swear she heard a horn blowing. She was desperately thirsty, and her head hurt. She'd been crying for an hour without realizing it, and squinting hard to try to make treetops into rooftops or telephone poles. In the thickening shadows, she could almost believe it. She'd lost her second sandal, too, without realizing it. And now it was getting dark. She began to shout for help, no longer caring who found her, wishing, now, she'd never run in the first place. She shouted until her voice broke and she couldn't bear it anymore. No one came anyway. And then she saw in the distance, Deliverance, a stone house, a roof overgrown with green moss. But a house. No, more than one house, three houses lumped next to one another, like fairy houses dropped by some miracle in the middle of the woods. If she'd been less desperate, she would have noticed the shattered windows, the doors angled off their hinges, the wood rot, and seen it for a settlement no one had entered in years, probably decades. If she'd been less tired, she would have noticed the low circle of stones indicating an old sunken well, with only a flimsy covering of ancient wood to keep animals from falling in. But she was desperate and tired, and the woods were dark. She tripped on the edge of the sunken well and saw briefly the small covering of ancient wood, like a trap door set in the ground. Then she crashed through it and tumbled down into the long, sleek mouth of a 30-foot hole.
Lyra, 21. She didn't exist, and then she did again. She was drinking water, and as the cold touched her lips and tongue and throat, it poured her back into herself. She was so startled she nearly choked. Dr. O'Donnell was gone. So was Selim. She couldn't remember where the water had come from. It was in a mug, and there was writing on the mug, but she couldn't seem to bring it into focus. The letters were meaningless geometry. She couldn't understand where Selim had gone, or Dr. O'Donnell, and in fact she couldn't remember their names or what they looked like, but only that there had been other people with her, a sense that she'd been left behind. The room smelled bad, and in a lined plastic trash can there was vomit mixed with a little blood. She knew it must be hers, but for a long time she stared at it, revolted and uncomprehending. She didn't remember throwing up. She tried to move to the window, but found that she was instead pushing on the door, pushing and trying to open it. The door was locked. She turned around and the room also turned, swung and changed direction. And just as the letters had disintegrated, the whole place had ceased to have any meaning. She saw lines and angles skating in space like the cleaved wings of birds in the sky, and she couldn't tack any of it down or make sense of it. Help! She wanted to say, but she couldn't find the word for help. There was a sound in her ears, a hard knocking, and after a bit she recognized that she was hearing her own heart, and the idea of a heart came back to her, four interlocked chambers webbed with arteries. At the same time, words loosed themselves from the dark hole and soared up to her consciousness. Room, chairs, rug. Every time she found the word, the shape of the thing stopped struggling and settled down and became familiar. She was still in the unused office. Selim had been with her, but he had argued with Dr. O'Donnell and now he was gone. Outside, the light had been reduced to a bare trickle that bled through the tree branches. It was evening, but Selim had argued with Dr. O'Donnell in the morning. She had lost a whole day. Think. Someone had brought her the mug of water. She was sure it hadn't been there earlier. That meant someone must be close, and in fact, when she went to the door again and leaned up against it, she could hear the murmur of voices. Dr. O'Donnell wouldn't hurt Selim, not when she wanted to use him to show off, so Selim must have been removed either to another room in the building or somewhere else entirely, which meant first that Lyra had to find him, second that they had to escape. Another wave of nausea tipped her off her feet, and she sat down and bent over, waiting for it to pass. At least she didn't throw up again. When she felt better, she moved to the file cabinets and opened all the drawers one by one, hoping to find something she could use to get out. But they were all empty. She didn't find so much as a pen cap. Even if she could slip out into the hallway, she would need an ID to swipe in and out of doors. But Dr. O'Donnell, wherever she was, had, of course, taken hers along. Think. Think. Along with the water, someone had left her a pack of gum, probably because she had been throwing up. Lyra got a small, electric thrill. An idea, a very small one, a very desperate one, condensed through the fog of her brain. She fed a wad of gum into her mouth and gnawed, then went to the door again. The murmur of voices, probably from an adjacent office, continued uninterrupted. Someone was watching TV. She lifted a fist and banged several times, and after a brief and muffled discussion, footsteps came toward the door. She quickly spat her gum into one hand and thumbed it into two portions. The door handle jumped around while someone took a key to it. When it opened, Lyra saw a girl with chunky black stripes in her hair and very thick glasses. "Oh," she said, and took a step backward as if she hadn't expected Lyra to be there. "Oh," she said again. "I thought I heard you knocking." "I need to pee," Lyra said. The girl tried to step in front of her, but she shoved into the hall, wedging the gum right into the locking mechanism, forcing it in deep, a trick Raina had taught her. The girl took a few quick steps away from her. Lyra realized she was frightened and didn't want even accidental contact. The halls were dim, and Lyra knew most of the employees must have gone home for the night, although she could hear the ghost clack-clack of invisible fingers on keyboards, and a few offices still spilled their light onto the carpet. In a narrow office across the hall, a boy was hunched over a laptop watching something. He quickly thumbed off the volume. Lyra's heart swelled. His ID was lying next to his computer, coiled inside its lanyard at the edge of his desk. Her fingers itched to take it. "What does she want?" the boy asked, jerking his head toward Lyra, and even though he sounded tough, Lyra knew he was afraid also and just trying not to show it. "She has to use the bathroom," the girl said in a desperate whisper as if it was a secret. "Where's O'Donnell?" "Still on the phone," he replied. "She said she might be a half an hour." So, Dr. O'Donnell was still here. That was good. It likely meant she hadn't taken Selim somewhere else, somewhere that would require a car. But Dr. O'Donnell had said she'd be back in half an hour. That didn't give her much time to look. "Should I take her?" the girl asked, still shying away from Lyra as though she were diseased. The boy blinked.
"Well, I'm not going with her."
"Dr. O'Donnell said not to go anywhere." The girl trailed off uncertainly. Fear could be used. The nurses at Haven had been afraid. They had acted as though the replicas had something sticky on their skin, something that might spread through contact and turn them into monsters. But back then, Lyra had not known how to use this to her advantage. Things were different now. "I threw up in the trash can," she said. "There's some on the floor, too." "We heard," the girl said. She avoided Lyra's eyes. Lyra knew the girl was afraid she wouldn't be able to find the difference between them, the reason she had the key to the room where Lyra was getting sick and not vice versa. "Did Selim get his medicine?" she asked. This made the girl and boy turn to stare at her. "The other one?" she clarified. "The male?" The girl looked worried.
"What medicine?"
she asked loudly, as if Lyra might otherwise fail to understand. "He has medicines," Lyra said. "He always takes them, otherwise he'll get sick worse than I did." She held her breath as the girl chewed on her thumbnail. If she went to get Dr. O'Donnell, Lyra would have to admit Selim didn't take medication. She counted heartbeats. 1, 2, 3. "Can you go and get Sonia?" the girl said finally, turning to the boy. Lyra let out the breath she'd been holding. "Can you ask whether the other one said anything about medicine?"
"Now?"
"Just ask," the girl said. "I don't want to get in trouble." The boy leaned to hoist himself to his feet. He grabbed his ID, winding the lanyard between his fingers, and Lyra's heart skipped down into her fingers. "In one of the cold rooms?" the girl nodded. "Sub 2, she said. And Lyra had to bite her lip to keep from smiling. Now she knew where Selim was. But she was careful to keep her face blank, to look as dumb as they thought she was, to watch without seeming to pay any attention at all. She saw the way the boy slipped his ID in his back pocket when he stood. "I really need to pee," Lyra repeated. She saw the girl relenting. "Come on, make it quick." Lyra followed her into the hall, head down, obedient as a cow, dumb, docile, harmless. The boy glanced at her with barely concealed pity before turning to lock his office door. She saw, the loop of lanyard visible above the stitching. All she had to do was hook it with two fingers as she was passing. Harmless. In the bathroom, she used the toilet and washed her mouth out in the sink. There was no time to wait.